Welcome to episode 416 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Ash Baker,
Michael O'Malley.
In today's episode, we're going to be talking about movies that we saw this week in part one. And then in part two, we're going to be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series with 1972's Pink Flamingos. So if kids are in the car right now, maybe pause that part two for later, because it's going to get, you know, it's going to get raunchy. It's as divine intended. Real quickly, head over to cinematary.com if you have not caught up with the series, or you're just kind of floating in because you want to hear us talk about John Waters, which is fair. Head over. We got the whole front half of our series. I mean, after this, we have three more movies left, so bunch more in the old archives if you would like to catch up on Young Critics Watch Old Movies. I was looking the other day, and our Bicycle Thieves episode that Andrew and I did is starting to pick up some interest. So good to see the young people are interested in Italian neorealist films.
Mozzarella sandwiches.
You know, poverty, government dysfunction.
Who doesn't love a mozzarella sandwich?
What's not to relate to?
All right, well, let's go ahead and jump into movies we saw this week in part one, and I think I got Michael, you down for the first one.
Okay. So I'm going to be talking about this movie from 1994 called Felidae. I think I'm pronouncing it right. Anyway, the name is the, like, animal family that the cat, like, house cats come from, in terms of, like, taxonomy. It's a German animated film from 1994, and it is wild. It's basically like a mystery story. So this cat gets he and his owner move to this new neighborhood, and so this cat, like, spends time, like, looking around the neighborhood, and he finds, like, that it's just this incredibly hard-boiled, grisly place. You know, like, within 5 minutes of arriving, he just sees this other cat with its throat clawed out and just, like, dead in the yard. And so he befriends all these other, like, neighborhood cats, and there's this whole, like, secret society of cats that are doing experiments on other cats for mystical, weird reasons. And the whole thing becomes, like, I saw someone compare it to Kiss Me Deadly, and I think that that's a pretty apt comparison, only if Kiss Me Deadly were starring cats and animated and kind of looked like maybe Oliver and Company, except with R-rated violence as the cats get disemboweled and stuff.
Yeah, I'm looking at images right now, and there is a decapitated cat.
Yeah, so,
I'm not watching that shit.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
I'm not watching
it. It's pretty grisly, but it's also pretty cool. Not the fact that cats die, but it's cool because it's like a really hard-boiled neo-noir, just completely filtered through what appears to be a family animated film, although it's obviously not, like, geared for families, but it's kind of in the vein of Watership Down or something like that, where you have kind of an exterior that is cute on some level that ends up being, like, this really bizarre, mystical, and violent tale about like, dark forces and, like, concentric rings of power within this neighborhood, where people are, like, these cats are just manipulating each other into doing awful things to each other. I'm probably not selling this very well, and it's probably a hard sell regardless.
I looked at the photos, and yeah. I'm out, so I can't watch that. I have two cats in the house. I can't be, like, showing them this content.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly not for everyone.
Why would I watch this when I could just watch Feifel Goes West again?
That's true. Feifel does almost get eaten in that. I remember being young and being kind of traumatized when Feifel almost gets eaten by the cat. But anyway, if the thing that I've described to you doesn't sound off-putting, it's a kind of interesting example of adult animation that doesn't often get, like, a lot of times adult animation is kind of edgy and funny and you know, like whatever, like The Simpsons or Ralph Bakshi, like something like that. And this is an example of something that feels like adult animation in the sense of we're trying to make a movie that might be geared toward adults if it were not animated. And so we're going to try to make an animated version of that using the tropes of animation, like animals and stuff, which I think is interesting. And I thought it was an interesting movie. It's not like an awesome, like amazing movie. It's like 80 minutes and it goes way too fast. Like it's the sort of story that it doesn't feel like it has as much gravity as it could because it's just like beat after beat after beat, you know, until finally you're meeting like Cat Hitler. And it maybe should have spent a little bit more time, you know, drawing out that. But it's an incredibly moody and interesting like piece of animation too, because like I said, like it kind of looks like Oliver and Company, and it's maybe like that caliber of animation where it's kind of like rough around the edges, but ultimately is pretty smooth. And
does it also have Billy Joel music?
No, it doesn't. It does have like, there's like a singer-songwriter ballad that plays over the opening and closing credits, which is not Billy Joel, but it's maybe like kind of like the Once Upon a Time in New York City place setting. For like German animation, there's really not a lot of it. And so it's kind of funny that this movie exists at all, but also that this movie exists and looks like fairly comparable to what Disney was doing, not in the 90s when this movie came out, but maybe in like the 80s before they started using computer assisted technology. Yeah, so there's an English dub, which I watched, but there, you can also watch it in German.
Wait, it's German?
Well, so the Germans made a movie with a cat Hitler?
Yeah, it's, I mean, maybe it's a reckoning of the Holocaust or something. I don't know. It's mostly just grim. Mostly just grim. I mean, it's not like 100% cat Hitler, but he's like, you know, torturing other cats for like bizarre mystical and like reasons surrounding like supremacy and domination. I mean, it's maybe baked in there somewhere. Anyway, seems like a tough crowd for this movie, but I got something out of it.
Do y'all not have any cats at the house?
No, we used to.
Well, now we know what happened to him.
Yeah, I know. Cat Hitler got him.
All right. Well, if you want to watch Fella Day,
it's on YouTube. You can.
It's on YouTube. But you if you're a cat owner, maybe watch it somewhere else, if at all.
You know, I will say the movie that we're about to discuss in part two involves an actual live animal being like brutally murdered on screen. So, you know, this is just not a great episode for animal lovers.
Yeah. PETA's going to come after us for this one. Whatever. All right. I'm going to toss it over to Ash to get us on something that I'm sure is much less animal murdery.
Yeah, I mean, there's a human murder, but that's whatever. Not as bad. So I watched Rainer Fassbender's last movie, Querelle, or however you say it in French. But basically, it's based on this French novel that came out in the late 40s. About gay sailors. And so basically the sailors come to town in Brest, France, and they go to this place where they like play poker and like get picked up and stuff. And anyway, I thought it was a beautiful story, even though like some of the like it was just kind of like jarring sometimes, like the plot jumps, but like it was a really beautiful story. And I really like all of the like aesthetics. It feels like it's definitely like on a built set where they filmed it, it seems like. And you've got this lighting that's like sort of not pretending not to be theater, and it's just kind of pretty, and the outfits are like really ridiculous, but they like they never once blink and like wink at the camera and say my outfit's ridiculous, right? It like leans into the narrative and it's like, yes, like this is completely sincere. And I really liked it. I've only seen...
Where does it stand on animal cruelty?
Where does it stand on animal cruelty? I don't think there's a single animal in the movie.
Yeah.
That's pretty cruel, I would say.
Yeah. To it also. Was this the first Fassbender movie you'd ever seen?
No, I've seen Ollie Fear Eats the Soul a few years ago, but this was the second.
Yeah. I have not seen any of his work, so I'm kind of curious. I put Fox and His Friends on the Young Critics ballot, but I feel like it's a like Fassbender is a famous director that we have never really touched at all.
Yeah, he's a really interesting character. Fassbender.
I was going to ask what was the movie that people chose instead of Fox and His Friends.
This one.
No, wait, no. Fassbender is not English, no, though, I know. Right?
Okay. No, it's next week's movie, In the Realm of the Senses, instead.
Oh, okay.
They were like, let's watch some horny Japanese people instead of watch whatever Fassbender's got going on.
I gotta say, we have a wild, like, 70s pick layout.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. If you kind of like, if you take away a little bit of like last week's Soy Cuba and go from like Faster Pussycat to Pink Flamingos and In the Realm of the Senses, like it's a real trip.
Ash, how did you feel like this compared to the Ali Fury Eats the Soul?
I was honestly sort of surprised when I looked up because I didn't know like where in his filmography that it landed. When I first watched it. And so I looked it up and I was surprised that it was his last film because Ollie Fear Eats the Soul feels very like contemporary in many ways, like just the way that it's shot and like the style and the, you know, but obviously like I wasn't alive when this movie came out, and I wasn't alive when the book it was based on came out, which, you know, he really, like, leaned heavy into the outfits of the time that the book would have come out, and it's excellent, but I wasn't alive at either of those times, so I, like, have no idea, basically, like, how it would feel to, like, live in the 80s or in the 40s. So yeah, I really appreciated it, but I just like, I think it makes me want to watch more of his movies because it just shows me like, oh, like he made this really great movie, Ollie Fear Eats the Soul. And then like, I watched this and it's like, like, it just, I feel like a lot of people will probably watch it and think, like, this is hilarious, but I think it's, like, really cool, because I think it's, like, very sincere, actually. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. No, I'm, like I said, I'm curious to get some Fassbender on the lineup to kind of engage with him. That would be kind of cool. Nice. Well, from gay sailors to Comanche Indians or Comanche Native American members in the early 1700s fighting predator. That's a nice transition. It's a seamless transition. Prey is the latest in the Predator franchise. I'll be honest, not a big Predator person. I was just like, you have this Comanche warrior in the Great Plains in 1719 fighting Predator. That seemed pretty fun to me. And it pays off on that level of just like, she's got like this tomahawk thing going on that like she has it like connected to her, and she like throws it and can bring it back and all this stuff. This is a nice animal movie. She's got a great dog. Great dog in the movie. But this is directed by Dan Trachtenberg, who did 10 Cloverfield Lane. And I guess also did some Black Mirror episodes. But yeah, I mean, pretty much you catch up with Naru, who's played by Amber Midthunder, who is an indigenous actress. And she is the skilled Comanche warrior, but she's not like... She's mainly kind of doing some hunting and such, but she's not like part of the hunting party and the people who are making decisions. And so I guess part of their tradition is that they have to have they kind of have to lead this big hunt and bring back the kill, and that kind of establishes them into that rank. And so she picks the Predator to be her, yeah, unknowingly. But it definitely plays with just the whole idea of you have Predator with like his little with just all of his like advanced technologies taking on this Native American warrior, and on that level it's pretty fun. It's like a little over 90 minutes. It moves very, very it's well paced. I mean, I really liked Dan Trachtenberg. At least he's 2 for 2 on, let me just do a random sequel to either a successful franchise or a successful property that nobody asked for, and we'll see how it goes. And both of them have been pretty solid. They're not blowing the world up, but they're just like, yeah, this is like a nice little genre picture that's like very tightly scripted, has great action, and like I had a good time for the 90 or so minutes that I was watching this. And same with 10 Cloverfield Lane. It has this it does really like the last sequence when it has this one sequence. So she runs into these French Canadian fur trappers at one point, and they capture her and her brother, and then are like, we are going to get the Predator. And you're like, oh, okay, French-Canadian fur trappers. And so they, like, use them as... They use Naru and her brother as the bait. But as they learn, like, Predator's just like, if you're just sitting there, I'm not going to bug you. But if you got, like, a weapon, it's over. And so there's, like, they're, like, there in the middle of this giant field with all the fur trappers all set up around it. And the sequence is just the Predator just like blowing through all these just fur trappers. And it's pretty great because they establish themselves as assholes ahead of it. So you get to just watch him like mow through them for an entire sequence. And then the last sequence when she's kind of trapping him finally is pretty great. It does have, I saw people pointing it out on Letterboxd, it does have like the CGI animals similar, not to the level of RRR, but like, but kind of similar to that. But I think it's fine. There's a great shot where like the Predator like lifts up this bear that he's like, this is not at the same time, not an animal friendly movie, but it's CGI. So he like lifts up this grizzly bear and like cuts open its stomach, and then like all this like blood comes on it, and then so you can't see the Predator because he's got his little like cloaking device thing, but then it's just like all this red on him to like outline him. That's just like, yeah, that's a crazy ass shot. I like it. But if you're looking for like a nice 90 plus minute tight action movie that is not super serious, check out Prey. It's on Hulu. Amber Midthunder, the main actress, is great. And a lot of tomahawk bow and arrow fighting, along with, I don't know the Predator lore and all his little weapons and stuff, but he's definitely got a little little thing for himself. So that's that. But more importantly, I want to talk about baller ass movie. That's Blue Collar, which is now on Criterion Channel. This came out in 78. It's Paul Schrader's first directed movie. It stars Richard Pryor, Harvey Keitel, and Yaphet Kotto. They have a Criterion Channel right now has a series of Yaphet Kotto movies, which is why this one's on there. But it's one that I actually like flagged a number of years ago to watch. But pretty much the movie is Richard Pryor, Harvey Keitel, and Yaphet Kotto are these three line workers at, I don't think they specify what the company is, but an auto plant in Detroit in the 70s. And when you kind of catch up with them, they're getting pissed off at the mistreatment that they're getting handed to them by like the plant management, and the foreman, and people like that. But then they also have their local union that's also kind of screwing them over. Their union rep's not fulfilling any of the requests that, especially Richard Pryor's character is asking for. And his literally is just like, hey, my locker's like messed up. It's been messed up for like 6 months. Can I get it fixed? And he gets kind of like this whole, well, we gotta pick our fights type situation. And he's just like, dude, I just need my locker fixed. And so they decide to, because of all this, and you know, you kind of get these scenes where their debts are being raised and they're having to figure out ends meet. They decide to go and rob the union headquarters, because at one point Richard Pryor is there and he sees in the safe there, and it's like they got a bunch of money and such there that, you know, they don't need because they're not doing anything, so we should go steal it. And when they go and steal it, they find, like, I forgot what it was. It was like $400 or $600 or something. But the main takeaway that they have is they get this, like, this binder of different interest loans and things like that that are kind of not adding up, that they can tell the union head is kind of fudging numbers in order to make money. And so this kind of leads them on their path, because then, like, you know, the police are getting involved, the feds are getting involved, the union's getting involved, and it's all kind of all falling on these three guys. But I thought it was awesome. It's a great movie. I saw somebody describe it as like the kind of last breath of New Hollywood, because it's just like this lean thriller with just three, like, every performance is fantastic. I guess Richard Pryor and Paul Schrader did not get along at all on set. Yeah, like they didn't, like it was not great at all. And so, but he's fantastic in this movie. Harvey Keitel is really great, and then Yaphet Kotto is just kind of like the buddy, the guy in the middle who, like, the two of them have like wife and kids and families, and Yaphet Kotto's like just this like player who's just like, yeah, I'm just having a good time. But yeah, just I think it's a lot smarter movie than probably it's giving credit for. I think it's this really sharp commentary on just how, on just the American, on just, you know, working in America and constantly trying to like crawl out of holes that you know, you're not necessarily digging for yourself, but is digging by being dug by others around you and the people who are employing you. And I think that the way the direction that it goes, and it's like third act it's kind of fascinating and really has like this, it reminds you of just kind of at the end of the day, everybody's just kind of trying to, well, do what they got to do to kind of keep themselves, and especially if like a family involved, like keep your family afloat. Michael, I know you've seen this movie. Do you have anything on Blue Collar?
It has like one of the most memorable endings of a movie I've ever seen. It's like one of those movies where it's a fairly linear movie, and with each like successive beat that the movie takes, you just get this like bigger and bigger pit in your stomach until like finally the end is just the biggest like just bummer of all.
It's a really, I mean, not to spoil too much, but like pretty much the kind of friendship between Richard Pryor's character and Harvey Keitel's character deteriorates. And there's just like this really, it's hard to watch and it's really sad because you've seen these guys be friends this entire movie. And then there's this exchange where Harvey Keitel's character calls him the N-word and like they have this kind of back and forth. And it's just kind of, it's really challenging to watch because you're just like, oh, these guys were like, you know, like the two families were bowling not 45 minutes ago, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, like, it's kind of wild because I think like there's like a Paul Schrader like trademark kind of movie, and this is so far from that in a lot of ways. And I think like a lot of his early career is really interesting because, you know, he's not quite like settled into every other movie is going to be a pickpocket riff thing yet. And I think this stage of his career is just like really interesting in that regard. Like a few years later, he made Cat People for some reason. And then there was this, which is like just such a, it's like probably his tightest screenplay just in terms of like, you know, structure and how it goes. And I think it's really great.
It has this very like, yeah. It has this percussion to it. You know, you're introduced to it at the very beginning of the movie, but Hardworking Man is kind of like this undercurrent of them while they're at the plant. And so you have Hardworking Man playing through the titles, and then it will have like this pause where it'll introduce like actors or directors or whatever that just kind of has like this rhythm to it. And then throughout the rest of the movie, whenever they're in like the auto plant working, it just kind of has like, you're usually Hardworking Man's like playing in the background, and it just has like this percussion to it. So like you just kind of get sucked into the monotony of like metal clanging and people tightening like car parts and things like that. That just, there's just such this, you get sucked into that monotony as you're watching it because you have those scenes where they're interacting there, but you just kind of feel this like rhythm beat that's kind of permeating under it.
Yeah, there's a really like amazing sense of place too with that factory just like on the line, and like to the point where it's like it becomes menacing in and of itself, right? Like there's a character who's murdered in the factory, and it's like done through the instruments of the factory itself, and it's just really, and
that's a really brutal, scary scene. Like it's not like you know, we'll talk about like horror movie, it's not horror movie scary, it's just the person is in the room where they paint the car, and so they have like a, you know, mask on and stuff like that, but then they lock him in, and so they can't get out, and you're just like, there's not any music. All you hear is like the paint brushes like spraying and going back and forth, and you can just feel them choking to death. And it's really disturbing. Brutal. Yeah.
But also like it's a scene that would only have that kind of power if the movie had done what it had done with like establishing the setting and just the really terrific sensory details that it has in there.
It was interesting. I was reading Paul Schrader at the time. I guess he was doing a talk in France, and they were asking him how, like, when he decided to make this make a political movie kind of like this, and he was like, oh, "I wasn't trying to make a political movie. I was just making a movie. Like, I was just making a movie about, you know, auto plant workers."
And I've seen that quote before, and that seems like such nonsense to me. There's no way you can make this movie and not think it's political.
It's a super political movie, and it kind of you know, it's not like overflowing with necessarily like deep leftist politics. It's more just like I said at the top, it's more just kind of people going, I just got to like pay my bills and like feed my family. And I don't want to get, I want to get as less screwed over as possible. And so to me, it kind of like plays on this very like human level of, it's not, let's less a right and left thing, and more just like a, yeah, these guys are just trying to survive and bring food home, and literally everybody around them is just trying to screw them over. I mean, I think the Richard Pryor character, I think all of actually all the characters have like at least two jobs. I don't see how they get any sleep. There's not like they're constantly, well, at the same time though, there's the one scene where Harvey Keitel goes and works at the factory, then goes and works at this gas station, then sleeps for like 3 hours, and then goes out and does cocaine and hang out with hookers with the other ones. So like at the same time, like prioritize your sleep maybe instead of going and hanging out with at the cocaine party. But yeah, no, if you have Criterion Channel or you can get access to this, I say check it out. I think it's a really smart, just like you said, like a tight script, just a really smart movie, that I think is as relevant today as it probably was in 78. And I feel like as Paul Schrader kind of gets more like, hey, let's talk about Paul Schrader with like First Reformed and Card Counter and things like that, hopefully people who like that stuff will check out this one.
Yeah, I do think that I had seen, like, before his kind of resurgence in recent years, I had seen like Taxi Driver and like his Scorsese his Scorsese collaborations, and I was surprised going back to his older movies how engaging they are. And like I said, not all of them are nearly so, like, I mean, I like Paul Schrader, but a lot of his stuff is by design very navel-gazy, you know, like lonely man sitting at night writing in a journal kind of like
thing. Yeah, and this is the complete opposite of that.
Right, and he's got a lot of movies that are kind of the opposite of that early on, and I think it's really interesting that, I mean, he eventually found his, like, transcendental style, like, thing that he really burrowed into, but I do think that it is fascinating to see like this early version of him who was like trying on all these different genres.
It's funny you mentioned his transcendental style. Friend of the pod, Darren Hughes, posted I think he watched this recently as well, and posted a screenshot of one part where you have like the Ford like steam stack and all the like metal buildings and wires kind of connecting everything. And it reminds, and he's like, I clearly like, Paul Schrader was probably thinking a little bit about Ozu in this, because especially in like his late period movies, Ozu gets like fascinated with like the industrial surge in Japan, and like has all of these like metal buildings and like buildings that protruding behind like homes and things like that. And so it felt very like in line with that. It reminds me a little bit also of something like True Stories by David Byrne, just in terms of like capturing like just, you know, Rust Belt, flyover America in like this beautiful way. So, Blue Collar, Aces, check it out. But we're going to take a quick break, and then we will be back, and we're going to be talking about John Waters' Divine's Pink Flamingos after this. Well, everybody's heard about the bird. And we're back with part two of episode 416 of Cinematary. In this part, we're going to be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movie series with 1972's Pink Flamingos. Written and directed by John Waters, the film stars Divine, David Lockery, Mink Stole, Danny Mills, and Mary Vivian Pierce. A bizarre woman and her misfit family compete with a Baltimore couple to be named the filthiest people alive. That's all you need to know about the plot. A title card appears in the opening credits with the following dedication for Sadie, Katie, and Les, February 1972. The names refer to Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Leslie Van Houten, three disciples of Charlie Manson. Waters later referred to the dedication in his book Role Models, apologizing for the reference, which was a sarcastic nod to the cult leader's Manson family and the murders they committed. Alan Lee Optical also receives a special thanks in the opening credits. The budget for Pink Flamingos was reported as $10,000 in an April 1997 issue of The Advocate and Village Voice. However, in April 1997 issue of Detour magazine, as well as the Hollywood Reporter review, claimed it cost $12,000. According to a April 1997 news brief in People, Waters' parents, Patricia and John Sr., provided the financing.
What a supportive mom and dad to give their child funding to make this movie.
Oh, they're coming back with their review later on. So we'll get back to Patricia and John Sr.
Oh, yes.
Filming took place in Baltimore in 1972 over the course of 5 months. Waters edited his original, quote, sound stripped 16mm film footage to create the final version, which was nicely aged by the process. A sound delay accompanied each edit in the early prints due to Waters' rudimentary technique in the look and style of the director's low-budget filmmaking came to be known as the Baltimore aesthetic, a term allegedly coined by Providence, Rhode Island art students. Divine's friend Bob Adams described the trailer where they lived as the trailer set for the movie as a hippie commune in Phoenix, Maryland, and noted that their living quarters were in a farmhouse without hot water. Adams added that ultimately Divine and Van Smith decided to sleep at Susan Lowe's home in Baltimore, and that they would awake before dawn to apply Divine's makeup before being driven to the set by Jack Walsh. Quote, sometimes Divi would have to wait out in full drag for Jack to pull the car around from back, and cars full of these blue-collar types on their way to work would practically mount the pavement from gawking at him. The final scene of the film would prove particularly infamous, involving the character of Babs eating fresh dog. This is feces, eating fresh dog shit. As Divine later told a reporter, quote, I followed that dog around for 3 hours, just zooming in on its asshole, waiting for it to empty its bowels so that they would film the scene. In an interview not in character, Harris Milstead revealed that he soon called an emergency room nurse pretending that his child had eaten dog shit to inquire about possible harmful effects, which there are none. There are none.
Surely not none.
Divine asked his mother, Frances Milstead, not to watch the film. I wish that she obliged. Several years before his death, though, Frances asked him if he had really eaten dog shit in the film, to which he said, quote, just looked at me with that twinkle in his blue eyes, laughed, and said, Mom, you wouldn't believe what they can do nowadays with trick photography. Screenings may have taken place as early as 1972, but sources cited the February 1973 opening at New York City's Elgin Theater as the film's theatrical debut. According to an article by director Gus Van Sant, Pink Flamingos ran as a midnight movie for 95 weeks in New York City and for 10 consecutive years in L.A. Jay Hoberman stated that Waters' controversial picture, quote, enjoyed the most sustained midnight popularity of any movie until David Lynch's Eraserhead. And the film took in more than $5 million in box office receipts by 1980. The film was initially banned in Switzerland and Australia, as well as in some provinces in Canada and Norway. The film was eventually released uncut on VHS in Australia in 1984 with an X rating, but distribution of the video has since been discontinued. The 1997 version was cut by the distributor to achieve an R18+ rating after it also refused classification. No submissions of the film have been made since, but it has been said that one of the reasons for which it was banned as a film showing actual sexual activity cannot be rated X in Australia if it also features violence. So the highest a film such as Pink Flamingos could be rated is R18+, would now not apply given that the depiction of actual sex was passed within the R18+ rating for romance in 1999, 2 years following Pink Flamingos' re-release. Water's own parents, also the film's financiers, never saw Pink Flamingos. In an April 1997 brief in People, Patricia was quoted as saying, quote, "We are very proud of John, but we just don't see any point in subjecting ourselves to that film." In his LA Times 1974 review, Kevin Thomas stated the film was, quote, "as funny as it is outrageous," but warned that Pink Flamingos was, quote, "for the very open-minded." In their 1974 review, Variety called it, quote, "surely one of the most vile, stupid, and repulsive films ever made." And during the re-release in 1997, Roger Ebert said, "John Waters' Pink Flamingos has been restored for its 25th anniversary revival, and with any luck at all, that means I won't have to see it again for another 25 years. If I haven't retired by then, I will." So, on that note, let's talk a little bit about Pink Flamingos. Ash, I'm gonna start with you because I know that you're a big fan of this movie and John Waters. So, what about this one? Just get you going.
Well, I think that you've sort of just given me like evidence to, you know, like just keep believing my belief because, like, you know, those reviews you just read, it's like Gus Van Sant thinks it's beautiful. But Roger Ebert fucking hates it. Well, Roger Ebert is a fuckhead. What did he ever do? You know? It's like, Gus Van Sant's an artist, you know? And it's like, I don't know. So, I think John Waters, as a filmmaker, and just, like, appreciating his, like, sort of rise as, like, rise in status and, like, the film community is just really interesting to me. And I think that, like, really at the heart of that is he just had something that he wanted to do and he did it in a different way every movie, but he still did that thing. And that thing was be utterly vile. And eventually people are like, you know, he's really sticking to the bit, you know, like, he's sincere about this, and you start to look at his movies in a different way, I think, once you realize, like, he might be being sincere, you know?
They're kind of sweet. Like, there's something sweet about his movies.
Yeah. Family values. He said this movie was about family values.
Well, like, the thing is, even though the characters might be, you know, these reviewers go, oh, well, these are vile, like, repugnant characters. Like, he does have, you know, this is very much a staple throughout most of his movies, especially his early ones, but, like, he still loves them. Like, he's just like, yeah, I love these gross weirdos. Like, who cares? Like, they're doing their thing. They're locked, you know, they're doing, I mean, like, the scene, and this honestly probably had the most, like, for me, out of the whole movie, had the biggest gross out was that he has, like, the party. I think it's, is it Divine's birthday or is it the mom? Yeah, so it's
with the pig head.
Yeah, and so they have, like, they have the pig head, but also you have the guy who's like, who, like, leans up and is just, like, puckering his asshole, and I was just like, Jesus.
Well, Surfing Bird, please.
Yeah, it really ruined the, you know, Family Guy has nothing on John Waters with the puckering asshole. But, like, you know, like, yeah, it's like this, it's just this, like, just gross, repugnant scene. But it's also like everybody's like, they all like each other. They all, like, they have their community. Like,
they're having a good time.
They're really not hurting anybody.
Look at his asshole go.
Well, they're not like the Meek Stole and David Lockery characters are actually hurting people. Divine doesn't seem to be, like, hurting anybody. At least you don't see anything. It's just like they're just kind of out there and they're doing their thing by themselves.
There's
something, like, weirdly,
she does kill people.
There's something weirdly utopian about it. Like, it's like a truly, like, inclusive community. And the thing that is so evil about the other couple is that they're posers, right? They're like bourgeois people who want to be vile, right? But they're not really, like, by definition, they're not, like, part of this utopian project because they want to, like, bring other people down. Whereas, like, in the scenes with Divine and that whole family, It's just like, you know what? The Eggman comes to visit, and we're just going to, like, have a chat with the Eggman. Or, you know...
I love eggs.
I was laughing at that scene because I'm like, you can't tell me there's not, like, people in Brooklyn who actually have somebody like that to bring, like, eggs they can pick out at their house. But, you know, it seems like a hipstery thing to do. But I'm like, yeah, here it's just like, no, Edith likes her eggs, and she gets all of them.
She loves eggs.
She's super into eggs. I also love, she entertains me in Female Trouble as well, but... Yeah. Edith Massey is super fun. Just like she spends the whole movie for the most part just in the crib thing, and then marries the Eggman.
And they live happily ever after. It's very sweet.
Yeah. So, how Ash? How many? I guess this is probably your favorite John Waters. I mean, how does this kind of rank or come up against other ones of his that you've seen?
Well, my favorite one to watch, just, like, in general, is probably Polyester. Just because it's, like, I'm not going to sit down to just, like, have a laugh and a feel-good movie and put on Pink Flamingos. You know, like, I don't know anyone like that. But it's, like, it's a kind of movie, like, when you do see it, you know, it's, like, you know, this movie, it's funny. And that's, like, part of the, like, chaos of John Waters is, like, you know, you could make a version of this movie where it was horrifying, you know, if you changed the tone of the movie, you know. But, like, if you just flip the switch and nothing was funny anymore, like, this would be a completely different narrative, I think. But, like... because everything is, like, funny and, like, theatrical and, I think it, sort of lends itself to being, like, a little uncomfortable because it's, like, oh, you know, like, this is horrifying, but, like, also it's kind of funny. So that's, like,
well, it's constantly kind of like bouncing around the line and then like crossing the line and bouncing. Like, it's just because like you'll have scenes where like, yeah, she's talking to the Eggman. But I think that's after Cracker, the one guy, has sex with the woman with the chickens involved. Yeah. And you're just like that.
That scene is the too much.
Yeah,
scene
that
for
one's
me,
that but... that one's a lot. But then you go to Edith talking to the Eggman and like love it. And then, you know, you go from like the scene. I love the beginning of the scene when he and Divine go to the couple's house and are just like spitting on everything. Because I'm just like, why are they just spitting on everything? But then it leads into the very infamous fellatio scene. You're just like, whoa. And then they also go down to like stop the child, well, not child labor, but the two chained up women who are having babies that they can sell to lesbians, as they say. I like that's also like the act itself is not funny, but when they're describing it, it's kind of funny because there's like, yeah, we have babies and we sell it to lesbians. Like, it's just matter of fact, like that's their business.
Yeah, it's like the political structure of like the underworld.
But it definitely just kind of bounces between the lines at a lot of the time, and you're just like, what the fuck's going on?
I think, like, the one thing that's the through line for me in a lot of, especially the early John Waters movies, where it they truly have the feel of, like, just folks hanging out and just doing, you know, weird shit. There is something just, like, even, like, when there's just absolutely detestable things going on screen, there's, like, a sense of camaraderie among the performers that I think is really electric in these early movies. I have no idea like what sort of like what John Waters' world looked like when the camera wasn't on, but like it captures the sense of like a world, this kind of like bizarre world that is completely unencumbered from like any sort of responsibility toward tradition or convention, and like, in some ways it's kind of horrifying, but in the sense of, like, these people are all together, all, like, contributing, like, 200% to this, like, completely bananas project. Like, there's something just really special about that, that is, like, so... Like, I've, you know, you can watch low budget movies and you can tell, like, there are most low budget movies that are, like, you know, just thread, you know, shoestring productions. Like, you can kind of, you can tell the ways in which, like, things just don't land and there's no on-screen chemistry or anything like that. But there's something about just the energy, like the communal energy of these movies. And especially, I think this one, which is maybe the most, like, ensemble energetic one of his early ones that I've seen. And I don't know, it's just like there's like the level of the plot that you're watching, so that's like kind of wild and engaging on some level, but then there's also just like the idea of this movie being made, and because it's so low budget and because there's so little pretense or like quote-unquote sophistication to the film style, like it feels a lot closer to like a document of that scene than you might get with a slicker production. And I love that feel to this movie.
Yeah, I agree. I think while watching this, I was thinking Female Trouble's a lot more structured and has a, just a stronger like through line that it's following. This one, like I like, there were parts that I enjoyed, but like I was saying, before we started this part, like anytime Divine is not on the screen, it's a little less entertaining because Divine is just such a like presence. And the other folks just get a lot of screen time and I'm kind of just like, no, when's Divine coming back and doing stuff? And I feel like there's just, even though there's crazy shit happening, there's like, ironically, there's like lulls in it to me where it's just kind of, you know, the couple are doing, like, you have the scenes where, like, the couple are following the David Lockery characters, like, showing his dick to these two teen girls. And then you have the one where he, like, shows his dick, and then it's a trans woman, and she, like, shows her dick, and then he, like, sprints off, like, completely afraid. And so, like, you kind of have that stuff, and it's just, like, these, like, kind of in-between moments that are fine, but also, I don't know, it's not, I'm much more engaged while watching, like, Female Trouble than I am watching, when I was watching this one, just because I think there's a little bit more going on, and I think that the side characters at least have a little bit more definition, even though I do agree with you, Michael, that just kind of the randomness and, like, the very home video feeling of this is kind of its strong suit.
I think I want to talk about the music a little bit because I love the music, and a lot of it is like doo-wop and kind of like early 60s like pop hits and like those sort of records. And I think that is so key to like the atmosphere of this movie, is that contrast. And it kind of like, in a weird way, and a not... reminds me of like what David Lynch would go on to do, especially in like the 80s, where he like kind of contrasts this kind of like old school like Americana like post-war vibe with like these really squirmy gross stuff, and in this movie that's going on as well, except that like it's squirmy and gross and kind of endearing. But I really like the music, and there's some like sequences that are just great. Like, isn't Divine like shoplifting meat, and it's like the girl can't help it or something? And then of course there's Surfing Bird, and then there's How Much Is That Doggy in the Window is playing for the dog poop scene, right? There's just so many great things in it. Like at first they kind of play as gags because of like the dissonance between the two, but usually these songs play for a long time, like a several minutes at a time. And by the end of that, there's like a weird synergy that goes on where it's not really ironic anymore. It's kind of like what you were saying, Ash, where after a while, it's so committed to the bit that it kind of wraps around to, this is kind of weirdly endearing and sincere. And I don't know, that's kind of a weird thing, an interesting thing for ironic needle drops to kind of cease to be ironic because you let them play out for so long. I don't know.
I was reading while looking up notes that I guess in the original cut that there's the Rite of Spring. It's at some point. I don't think it's in. It's not in the 97 re-release, but they use the Rite of Spring at some point in the 97 re.
Like the modern classical
yeah,
piece.
Yeah, and like whenever the 97 re and like John Waters was having to get the rights to the music, they were just like, no, you can't use the Rite of Spring for this movie. The Sanctity, Stravinsky.
Who owns the Rite of Spring? Who owns the rights to the Rite of Spring?
Whatever. I guess, maybe the Stravinsky estate. I don't know. But they were just like,
gosh,
no.
What a bunch of posers.
But I can only imagine like that sequence. You mentioned when Divine is shoplifting meat. I like that sequence because there's the guy who like comes over and I forgot if it's like a sausage or something. He didn't have his dick out, but he like gets a sausage and he's like waving it in front. And like Divine doesn't even really react. Divine just kind of looks at him and just like, whatever. And then like just like grabs the meat and just like walks out the door. And he's like on the ground, just like wagging the sausage. Like just it's like incredibly. And that's pretty much a lot of the vibes of this movie. It's just somebody doing something like that. And you're like, and they just kind of like walk around it. I also like you going back to kind of the whole thing about the community feel. I like that how like insular this feud for filthiest person alive is. It kind of it's like, you know, it's Divine's family against this couple that live in Baltimore, and it feels like a feud between like the five of them and maybe like four other people.
But somehow like it gets magazine
yeah,
coverage
but it's,
and media coverage.
it feels like a medieval feud to me, where it's like, you know, how dare thee accuse me of being less filthy than you? I have reigned this kingdom for years. And so it's like, and then we get like the fulfillment where he like comes onto the property and Divine's like, no. And so that's my interpretation.
It's very
of the
Shakespearean,
movie.
You know?
Yeah.
This is John Waters
yeah.
Shakespeare.
I do think it's funny yeah, though. It's... Like, doesn't. Am I remembering like the feud starts when like the other couple like gets like a magazine or whatever on the cover, it says Divine filthiest person alive, and they're just scandalized.
Yeah, it's just like Divine like it's just like a basic photo yeah. of Divine's like, and it's like filthiest person alive.
I love the escalating war too, like when they mail the poop to Divine.
Yeah, I was going to mention that because I was just listening to a podcast recently, and they were talking about, this is kind of old news now, but it was like these croquet players, these like professional croquet players in the UK, like two of them, it would be like, I guess, like if golfers here, got, I don't know, I don't understand croquet, but anyway, these two professional croquet players got mailed a used piece of toilet paper in the mail like every month for like years.
Did they respond?
And,
like,
and so that's like
oh so, my God, someone sent me a bowel movement.
it's like, because like, basically one of them confessed on Twitter and was like, I've never told anybody this, but this has been happening for 10 years now. And like, it really bothers me. And like the other croquet player, the like famous croquet player was like, me too, dude. Like it's been happening for 6 years. Like, and so that's what I think of when I like think of this, like, I cannot believe, you know, just like, you know,
so like, oh, who did this? This is the most outrageous.
Yeah.
I can't deal
yeah.
with it.
That's what I think of.
There's also such a, like, I mean, nobody's coming in here expecting like world-class acting, but there's like this like very like charm to the like unexperienced actor quality of all of this. Like I love somebody like, I love listening to somebody like Edith Massey talk, and you know, there's no like like theatrical training to it. It's just her just kind of like, and I want to see the Eggman. I like to have this egg, the brown egg and the white. You know, it's just like this very matter of fact way. And other than,
but it's so good.
For the most part, everybody has it. Other than Divine, I think still kind of has that, that quality, but at the same time, he definitely does elevate it to a degree where like the spin that's on it, you can, is very satirical and overblown.
I love also the narration, which I think is John Waters, right? Yeah,
John Waters,
great because it has that kind of amateurish quality, like you just like stuck a microphone up in someone's face and like put the script and they're just reading it. But also there's just this really like hammed up accent going on, and I don't know, like there's just something about it that I think is just really fun.
Kind of broadly, I mean, how do you all think John Waters plays for like do you think, you know, 18, 20, 25, like that kind of range, people kind of getting into movies and kind of seeking out stuff outside the normal realm. Like, do you think John Waters still plays for current audiences, or is it kind of still very much outsider?
I mean, he's become kind of an institution, right? I mean, he's in the Jackass movie. He's in Alvin and the Chipmunks. He's in, I don't know, like, I knew who John Waters was before I had seen any of his movies. Like, he's kind of that kind of person. I don't know, that's kind of interesting to consider. Like, this person who is, like, the most outsiderish of outsider art becoming a kind of institution unto himself. I don't know, like, maybe some people find that depressing because it's, like, corporatized or whatever, but there's something kind of cool about the guy who made Pink Flamingos is now just like vibing.
No, I love it. I think it's incredible, and I think that it's like well deserved, I guess, too. Like, but I, in preparation for this recording, I watched the Simpsons episode with John Waters, which is absolutely phenomenal. If you all haven't seen it, highly recommend. He's a character. I also watched him on Stephen Colbert in preparation. He's a chill dude.
He's very much like, he's John Waters, you know. It's like,
he's hilarious.
There's no,
I like,
yeah, there's no,
I, yeah, I love him. I cited him in my thesis. Like, I think he's a genius, and I want him to adopt me.
At the same time, like, I do remember I watched some, like, the first John Waters movie I watched was Hairspray, which is not super representative of his stuff. But then I watched, like, Polyester, and I'd seen a couple other of his later films. And I remember going back and watching, like, some of his early ones, like Pink Flamingos or Multiple Maniacs or whatever, which I only just recently watched. And there is something very distinct and shocking about these early ones that I don't think I was prepared for, knowing who he was. Like, I had heard, like, wow, Divine eats poop and all this sort of stuff. But I don't know. There is something kind of in these movies that is a bizarre fit with maybe the more cuddly image that he has now. And like, I don't know, I've never shown this to someone who's 20. But me watching this for the first time, which I think was last year or 2 years ago, I remember thinking like, oh wow, this is another level of depth that I wasn't quite ready for. Like, I was ready for like the camp and like the kind of amateurish qualities, but the like, just a baldly transgressive, like really like hardcore punk rock kind of ethos, I think was shocking despite me being familiar with what his cultural legacy was. And so, I mean, I've ended up really liking a lot of this stuff, but I do wonder, like, even people who are familiar with like the kind of public persona of John Waters right now, you know, how would they feel going back to this? Like, I'd just be curious.
Well, I asked the question mainly because, like, I think especially, not that his films are explicitly, like, supposed to be queer movies, but I think that there is, like, that queerness encapsulated in them. And I feel like it's a little bit different than the kind of representation that people are kind of seeking in queer movies like today, where there is just kind of this abrasiveness to these movies, not because they were like truly struggling with their identity, but more just, it's more a product of the environment. Like that's what they're kind of, they're doing these, like they're being these vile, repugnant, like gregarious characters because they're, you know, John Waters and Divine, all these people are lashing out against the society they were growing up around. And I wonder if people today kind of going, oh, let's explore this, would connect with that or feel like it almost is doing a disservice to have, you know, Divine eating dog shit.
I feel like, I don't know. There is, I think in the last few years, there's been maybe like a reclamation of like that kind of like older, more radical, like outsider, like counterculture status, like the whole like be gay, do crimes meme, you know, that sort of thing, I think has become more in vogue than it maybe would have been. I don't know. I can't say because I have not watched this movie with the young queer audience. So that's just my thought.
I was the young queer audience. I can speak to the young queer audience. I saw this and I was like, fuck yeah. We're eating cops tonight.
That was a great
brother.
Scene too.
It's my birthday party. Show me that butt.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I don't know. Like, I feel like that camaraderie is something that I relate to. Not that like me or any of my friends have ever done anything so vile, you know, but it's like, you know, I watching the documentary about Divine or whatever, and I forget who it was. It's been years since I've seen it, but she was like, yeah, it was the 70s and we were, you know, we were the punks and we ate meat. And I was like, yeah, like they didn't really subscribe to, like, I think like the early essence of punk rock is not really subscribing to any sort of brand or label. And so when you grow up queer in a place like John Waters grew up, or like, you know, here, you know, it's like you don't have the language to put a label on anything. And so it's like, this is just the gang, you know. Here we
yeah,
are.
That's what's fascinating about this. I also just ask because, you know, like especially like lesbian and gay culture has become so co-opted into like the corporate world now, and it's interesting to kind of watch this movie, which is so like otherworldly to like the corporate world. Well, I mean, now you got, you know, rainbow banners on like Target, you know, for Pride Month and stuff like that. You know, it's like now, like I think when this, like Pink Flamingos or something is coming out, that was still at least widely through the country, probably not in places like Baltimore or LA or New York. That was relatively widely like taboo, and like there's something like, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but like you have, it's almost like you have this taboo subject, at least in 1972, and you have just the most repugnant characters doing the most repugnant stuff. And I think it plays for the audience they want to play, but at the same time, if you're just like random person across the country catching this, you're just like, what the hell is up with
this? I don't
think
a lot of people, random people across the country, were probably catching it when it first came out.
Probably not. Yeah.
It premiered in like a what was it? It wasn't like a theater. It was like a cafeteria. Yeah, it premiered in like a cafeteria. So it's like, I don't think, you know, a lot of people were watching this in the very beginning.
Yeah. It's just I hope that, you know, younger people who are like trying to like find, go and explore film, like include John Waters in that journey. Cause I think especially like from the ones I've seen, like this one and especially Female Trouble, which is pretty much like, let's have The Star Is Born, but with Divine and make it super sad. I think John Waters is definitely somebody like worth engaging with, especially like when it comes to like exploring American movies and American counterculture movies.
I think also there's something, I don't know, like there the moment that we're living in now in which like everyone has the capacity to document themselves and do things on camera, is weirdly and interestingly parallel to like what John Waters was doing. I don't think it's an accident that, you know, he appeared in a Jackass movie. I mean, that whole idea of let's set a camera down and do things that are like borderline self-destructive, like all in the name of just being extreme and edgy. And that in and of itself has become kind of like an element of, you know, internet culture, especially like, you know, all these, you know, YouTube videos or TikToks or whatever. Like there's the ones that are very like pristine and slick or just kind of like, you know, not that great. But there is like an element of TikTok or YouTube where when people document themselves, there is this sort of like razor's edge quality of, you know, chaos and unpredictability that the medium allows because people have access to it. And like anyone has the ability to record themselves. And there's that feeling in like the John Waters movies too, like where just this act of documenting things, like whatever it is, like in and of itself feels like liberatory and radical, because of who gets put in front of the camera and who is allowed behind the camera and all that, like who's involved in the production. And like there's an element of like the way that media has completely been blown up and opened up by digital photography and smartphone cameras and like,
yeah, I mean, everybody has like a high, especially depending on what iPhone you have. Like if you have one of those newer ones, I mean the cameras on those are as strong as, you know, getting a DSLR camera or something like
right,
that.
Right, but even like I mean, like it's like a thing with like, for instance, like when you mix your audio, like on a Vine or TikTok, like there will be some people who will intentionally clip the audio, right? Just to like, you know, be funny or weird. And like, I think that is in some way like in the legacy of John Waters, where it's like, we're gonna, you know, we have the ability to make it something that's like slicker and more conventional, and especially with a lot of, like the kind of filters you can put on like a Snapchat video or something like that. You can make something look fairly like decent and slick, but this desire that people still have to just be transgressive on camera, and like transgressive in like a stylistic sense, or like just a bizarre, I'm going to film myself doing something kind of strange and off-putting sense. Like, I don't know. Like, I think that there's like a sort of spiritual successor to John Waters and some of that.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a good point. Anything else on Pink Flamingos before we wrap up? Did everybody say what repulsed them the most over the course of this movie?
It was the chicken scene.
Ash, anything that just gets you?
I'm trying to think. There's like, I don't know. I think the scene in the house with the, but also the, just like the eating scene is also like pretty gross. Just all the scenes are pretty gross in general. The dog shit scene really is pretty gross. As you know, it's all pretty gross.
The blowjob scene, just like, less that it's a blowjob and more that the character is technically is Divine's son. Like, that's where it becomes like, you're like, oh. Mm. And just the whole setup of, like, the women chained in the basement.
I actually don't really like that part of the movie. And, like...
Yeah, that just that whole setup is
Yeah, just, it gets really gross, too, like, when he gets the syringe and stuff. But, you know, whatever. You do you, John Waters.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you know, I mentally prepared myself the whole day yesterday to go into it. I'm like, I know what I'm getting into. So, you know. Ready to ride.
You're rewatching it. Like, the first time I watched it, I was like, wow, that was really something. And I enjoyed it, but I was like, that was really intense. And this second time, like, it was genuinely enjoyable, like, the movie was to me. Like, the second time, like, once I knew what the things were that were coming and I didn't have to be afraid of each new shot, what did each new shot offer? Like, it was a genuinely, like, pleasant experience to watch this. And, I mean, that's probably not going to be the case for everyone, but...
Well, I think that, like, initial thing, like, you know, like, every scene is kind of like a jump scare. You know, the first time you watch it, it's like, you know, you don't know what's gonna happen. You know, there's surprise in every scene. And so I think the more you watch it, the more you can, like, anticipate the, like, uncomfortable or, like, gross moments. It's like, all right, you know.
Yeah, I'll have to watch it a second time. It is, I think the Criterion Collection just put out a release of it, so I'd be curious to see how they kind of rework it and kind of get it up to, like, the quality bump they give it.
Ash, have you watched it with an audience? Like, I've watched it both times on my own, and I think I want to see it with an audience.
I've not seen it, like, with an audience. I've seen it, like, by myself, but also, like, with a few other people, if you count that as an audience, just, like, not, like, a full theater, you know, sort of thing, which I feel like would be a crazy experience. Yeah. I would love to do that.
Central Cinema, if you're listening.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're the only one in town who's going to do it.
Yeah.
No, honestly, I would definitely go and watch this again if it was, like, in a theater with a bunch of people, just everybody reacting to it. That sounds like I can't imagine the midnight screenings in LA for 10 years or whatever of this. Like, that sounds incredible.
I saw like, my first movie back in theater after COVID for a while was I saw Jackass Forever when it came out, and it was such a rewarding experience seeing it in the theater with a bunch of other people just reacting to all the stuff, you know, similar to, I feel like, a John Waters experience in a way.
I honestly went and saw Jackass Forever also in theaters, and it was a wonderful experience. Everybody's just, like, enjoying it. It's feel real community. It's great.
Well, he's in one John of the Jackass Waters movies.
I think it's the second one.
All right, well, that'll wrap up this episode of Cinematary. Oh yeah, no, it's great. It's the second one. It's fantastic. But that'll wrap up this episode of Cinematary. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary and on Twitter and Instagram at cinematary. Go to letterboxd.com/cinematary if you want to keep up with the movies that we talk about in this episode. If you'd like to support the show, whether it's $1, $5, or whatever you would like to give, you can go to patreon.com/cinematary. Thank you so much to our patrons: Cam, Chad Newsom, Corey Willingham, Candace Sisson, Ron Hayes, Teresa Marsathi, Titus Arthur, and Tyler Chandler. Thank you so much for your patronage. Like I mentioned before, next week's film is the 1976 film In the Realm of the Senses, and I feel like our crazy fucked up level will still say it's going to stay on the same level. So we're just going to work that wavelength for a while. Less poop. It's just a lot of different types of sex. With some Eggman's coming back. Who doesn't want eggs delivered straight to their house in, like, a nice little fancy box?
I would let the Eggman in.
All right. Well, thank you guys for listening, and we will see you next time.